on my pillow that won't dry on their own. Beyond my years, I've no sorrow, but today I don't walk alone. Step by step, step by step, I'm on the road to recovery, trusting God along the way, trusting God along the way, trusting God all the way.
Welcome to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Groups. It's our Thursday night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. Everybody gets settled in. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Jessica. Thanks for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our two-minute meditation. So please take a moment to get situated. Please turn off all devices and make sure that it won't distract anybody. Basically, just put your phones away. If you need to go outside or have a side meeting, you can do it outside. Please keep your feet off the kneelers at all times. That's for our church. Let's take this time. During the meditation, you're going to take the time to get connected to God. You let the craziness of the day drift away and ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. So is everybody ready?
Yes.
Awesome. So let's get started. Start with the fog light prayer. If you don't know it, there's these little yellow cards in front of you in the pews. You can read it front. Help us. God, let your love shine through me like a fog light so those whom are lost, sick, and dying can find your love through me. Amen. There is a solution from the big book Page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we've discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmless action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I've asked Katie to read Appendix 2, Spiritual Experience. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one. So it's kind of important to know what one is.
I'm Katie and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Katie.
The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Sorry. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most empathetically, we wish to say that an alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There's a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance, that that principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer.
Okay, if you guys can please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. And again, this is tech-free, so set your phones on airplane, meeting mode, or just turn it off. Now, tonight we have Miriam, and she's pretty awesome, I got to say. I've heard her share before, and it's very, very powerful to me, anyway. I received a message from her. It's very powerful, and I was very much looking forward to this talk these next 12 weeks with Miriam, mainly because I was looking for somebody that I admire so much in this fellowship that loves God so much that, you know, her aura and her soul kind of just is a light, and it's very cool. And so Miriam's starting the series this next 12 weeks, and I just want to introduce her, and let's welcome Miriam.
I'm Mary, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. It's an honor and privilege to share my experience drinking hope with you all tonight. And I want to thank Michael and the group for kind invitation to do that, to bring some girl power to the 12-step series, right? I love it. I'm so psyched. And usually what happens is I get so much going on, and it's like, okay, God, just out of the way, and it feels like it's all going to kind of come up at one time. So anyway, I'm psyched, and I got all my little gotsas here, all my little the right bracelets that mean things, and the rosary on the side, and bookmarks in hopefully the right places. And most of all, more than anything, I hope you hear my heart tonight, and I hope you hear my love for Alcoholics Anonymous, my love for God, my love for this fellowship, my love for my life today, because it certainly didn't start that way. And I've learned everything about my life today. I came in the rooms November 11th, 1989, and by God's grace, next month I'll celebrate 27 years. And I keep doing what I'm doing. And I have a sponsor in good standing in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Her name is Polly P., and she has a sponsor. And I sponsor a lot of women, and I get to do the deal. I get to do the deal, and I'm happy, joyous, and free today. And that's certainly not the way I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. The rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a life beyond my wildest imagination. Like, whoa. And you're going to hear over the next 12 weeks, I'm pretty transparent. If I'm freaked out, I'm going to tell you I'm freaked out. If I'm sharing something that's really candid, you're going to hear that it's really candid. If I don't know what the heck I'm doing, you're going to hear that too. I kind of deem myself a Lucy Ricardo of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll probably trip and fall and, you know, please God, no. But, you know, that's just it. I'm going to come to you real, and I'm going to come to you me. And I'm a partner of Peter Marinelli. I'm engaged to him, and he's a really, really hard act to follow. So, but it's beautiful because in this fellowship, we get to walk hand in hand in the fellowship of the Spirit together. And there's times where he's on the podium and he's my teacher, and I'm at the podium and I'm his teacher. And there's times he can call me out on something, and I can call him out on something. And, hey, maybe you want to call your sponsor. And, hey, maybe you want to work with a drunk. And, you know, just it's a beautiful walk today. It's a beautiful walk today. And so I'm grateful. More than anything, I hope you hear that. And most important, if you're new to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I hope you find what I've found here. You know, people that would tell me, you know, we'll love you till you can love yourself. And I had no love for me. You know, they taught me to act like a woman of grace and dignity, to hold my head up high and to be proud of who I was. And that is not how I came in these rooms. You know, my first job I got in sobriety, I was waiting tables at first, and I was pushing grocery carts, and I was doing things like that, and then I got a for real job where I became a saleswoman at a radio station, and I started, you know, dressing the part, you know, and I was embarrassed to go to a meeting in a dress, and I had the old timers telling me, you show those newcomers, you show those ladies what it's like to be a lady. What it's like to be a lady. And I'm pumped, man. I'm excited. I was in the bathroom and I ran into a couple girls in there. And this girl looked at my big book. I can't remember where she's at, but she looked at my big book and she's like, wow, you know, I want my big book to look like it's in pieces, you know? And this other girl said, yeah, I want to be a big book thumper. And I said, good. Good, because that's a little bit of what we're missing in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in women. Is sometimes what happens is we tend to, old time, and this is just a theory, a thing I've watched. So, you know, a lot of times women, you know, it's like we go through the steps and then we can go backwards through the steps and we can find, okay, we go home and we take care of the husband and we take care of the kids, which is all the gifts that sobriety's given us, but we forget what got us here in the first place. I know that I know that I know that a loving, caring, gracious, merciful God got me here. And it was not of my doing. When I had that last drink on November 10th, which happened to be my 30th birthday, I had matted hair. I had 80s matted, 80s perm, if anybody was alive back then or knows. You know, it was matted. I was in the closet. I was doing other non-conference approved whatever dry goods to go along with my box of wine because a bottle was never enough. That I had to have it on tap, you know. And I was swearing off with or without a solemn oath all the time. And every time I wanted to quit, I meant it. I meant it with my whole heart, but I just couldn't do it, you know. And going back, you know, going back to me and where I come from. So I'm gonna share a bit of, you know, my story tonight to set a foundation of letting you get to know me. And you know, I was born in Bellingham, Washington, which is 80 miles south of Vancouver, British Columbia, and about 86 miles, exactly 86 miles north of Seattle, Washington. And my town made the Guinness Book of World Records in the 70s for having more hippies per capita than anyone. And I was proud of that, man. I was, whoa, we got more hippies. And I think it's even more that way today. They recycle like crazy. There's roads that are closed down for bicycles only. You know, there are Birkenstocks and socks everywhere. You know, that's where I come from. That's my roots, you know. And this has always been a piece of me, but I have always, I mean, when I found the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was everything to me because I was the kumbaya girl. Can't we all just get together and, you know, peace and love, man? But how do I do that without the drugs? And how do I do that without the alcohol? How do I do that? How do I find that place? And when I came in here and you guys told me those things, like I said before, we'll love you till you can love yourself. You know, a fellowship where I could say out loud the things that were, you guys would say the things out loud that were screaming in my head. And I was like, that identification, they're just like me. They're just like me, and they understand. You know, Peter always talks about, you know, we're the only people in the human race that, you know, we can say the deepest, darkest, most ugly thing to somebody. Hey, what's your name? Oh, my name's Gideon. Gideon, last night I robbed a bank, and I puked in the toilet, and I punched a guy in the face, and Gideon says, yeah, welcome. Here's my number. You know, we're the only people on the face of this earth that do is our deepest, darkest things that actually happen to become our greatest assets. And we get to become, God does this work in us from our deepest, darkest places that he actually uses to save lives. What? Doctors, firemen, you know, I don't know, all these people, all these life-saving people out there, and he takes a wretch like me. He takes a wretch like you. Sorry, I'm going to qualify you. You know, he takes us and he helps us to transform and save lives. All by his mercy, all by his grace, not by something we earned. We didn't go to college and earn a degree just because we're messed up. Ragamuffin little, I don't know, tigers. I don't know. So... anyway, so from that town in Bellingham, Washington, I was born into this family. My mom was born and raised in Alaska up in the Aleutian Islands, and it was a horrible past, you know, horrible past of incest and deprived and, you know, horrible past. And, you know, and my dad, he was a World War II veteran. Yay, Dad. I'm so proud of him. But his dad died when he was 6 years old, and he had 8 brothers and sisters. And you know, my mom and dad were real alcoholics. And they were busy raising us 6 kids. And there was 3 boys and 3 girls, and I always like to say we were the dysfunctional Brady Bunch. And I was the middle girl. And I always wanted to be the older girl. I always wanted to be Marsha, you know. I did. And man, I had a horrible spiritual experience with the Brady Bunch. I would watch that show and go, God, I want that to be me, you know. And I don't say this for, I just say this, I just say this for, this is a piece of who I always will be, is this little girl who would go to school, that the teacher would wash my face and comb my hair. The first time I felt super shameful, there was a hot lunch ticket that the teacher held up one day and said, "Whose is this?" And that day, of course, like every other day, I made my own lunch, and I had a plastic bread bag with a peanut butter sandwich in the bottom of it, and that was my lunch. And I was hungry. And I said, "Yeah, that's mine." And I lied. And I got home and I got in trouble. And I was hungry. That was a need, you know. And so, you know, we were the house that nobody came over to, and there was whiskey glasses against the wall, and my brothers and sisters would be upstairs, and I'm like the, in a dysfunctional family, we all have our roles that we play, and I was the peacekeeper, and I was, you know, I was the good kid in the middle with the good grades. And, you know, when mom and dad's fights would break down out downstairs, in the middle of the violence, they would send me downstairs to break it up, because I could get dad away, and I could get mom, and I just, like, I learned, I know this in my heart of hearts today, that I learned to play God at a really young age. I could get in there and I could change a circumstance just by later on in life, you know, fast forward, you know, I found the panacea for my ills at 15 years old. Middle school was like, I'm the good kid. I'm getting the good grades. I'm staying out of trouble. All the heck is breaking out around me and my brothers and sisters, but I'm trying to stay on track and I'm trying to be the good kid. And middle school was great. Like, I was a champion gymnast. I'm singing solos. I sing all over the place. I'm like just thriving, and life is good. And there's two high schools in my hometown. And all my friends went to one high school and I went to the other. And during that summer, it was a profound change of all those girls going somewhere else and me going somewhere and being alone. So I found that loneliness that few do, that it says in our alcoholism. And I was alcoholic before that first drink. But what I found was a panacea for my ills. I went to a high school dance. I had ripped off a bottle of MD 2020. It used to be really easy to steal back then because they're flat. And it went inside my jacket. And, you know, the first gulp went down and I puked it in the toilet. The second one went down and I'd arrived. You know, and I had a new identity. I'm the party girl with the borrowing everybody's car with the keg in the back of the car, and I'm off. And it's not a problem. It's a solution to the problem. You know, it's a solution to what ails me inside, the spiritual dilemma, the place I walk. It's the answer. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to take a glass of water here, a drink. Hold on. So high school's not going good. I go to a party with a bunch of friends, and there's this guy, and he's just like really hot, and he's got like the stretch cords. I used to wear these elastic stretch cords, right, John? And no shirt, built, wow, and he's ticked off, and he's in a fight with the guy across the room, and instantly I fall in love. Like, I am like, whoa, who's this guy? You know? And looking back, I know what I found, and I know what I found in that moment for me was I had found my father, and I found someone to fix, because I was a fixer. You know, all this time I tried fixing my dad, and now I'm going to fix this guy. And so I end up pregnant. My dad's working in Alaska. I'm dad's little girl. I get this makeshift little hippie marriage by the river, you know, and I'm pregnant. And I'm still in my alcoholism, guys. It's like, you know, I'm not proud to say that. I drank through that pregnancy. I don't know how much or whatever. But when it's back in 1979, there's not a whole lot of stuff we know about that, you know. It wasn't like, hey, don't drink when you're pregnant. It was ever even said, you know. And so I get busy. I get busy having babies. We moved to Seattle. I had three stair-step children. Brandon was first, then I had Jake, and then I had Jessica, and they were 14, 15 months apart. And by the time Jessica was 4 years old, you know, I'm a stay-at-home mom, and, you know, I'm doing and I'm giving my kids everything I never had. They had a clean towel in the morning. They had a toothbrush. They had their beds made. And then I put them to bed and the game was on. You know? And that's how I was in my life. I was the secret closet housewife drunk is what I became. And I knew there was a problem, and it's just coming and it's coming and it's coming. I ended up pregnant again for the fourth time, and when Jessica was four. And I was excited. It was like this renewal. I was like, okay, I have these three kids all in a row. Now I'm pregnant with my fourth child. And we were excited, you know, because it's like they were all steps, you know, so close together. I'm doing diapers and bottles at the same time, and I get them to a certain age. I'm pregnant with my fourth child. And on October, actually yesterday was his 30th birthday, and these guys know that. I work with these guys. And he was born, my son Brian Daniel was born on October 19th, 1980. Six and three when he January 22nd of 1987, he was 3 months and he was 3 days old, and I had gone back to work to push those grocery carts. Now my little sister was babysitting him, and she went into the bedroom to pick him up, and she came running out, and he was purple, and I don't know what's wrong. I don't know what's wrong. And I'm just like, give him mouth to mouth. Give him mouth to mouth. And the hospital was like a few blocks away, and we handed him over to the nurse, who turned out to be Nurse Ratchet, because in that instant, she said, your son is dead. And I just collapsed on the floor of that hospital that day. And, you know, after never losing anybody near me in my whole entire life. And I can tell you, yesterday was his 30th birthday. And I can tell you that when I get the privilege, wherever I am, to speak in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a memory to him. It's in my heart. Brian, you guys will know Brian. I will talk about him a few times in this. And so Brian dies of January 1987. And this pastor walks me and my family through the whole thing. I have no idea what it's like from, I'm just trying to be a mom, I'm trying to be a wife, and the whole time I'm drinking and I'm drinking and I'm drinking because there's not enough alcohol to kill the pain. And August of that same year, August 16th, 1987, my mom suddenly dies. And she was ill. She was in a nursing home for a little bit. And we were like in such denial. Like I totally believed she was going to be okay. I remember her looking me in the eye and saying, Marion, do you think I'm going to die? And I said, no. No, Mom, you're not. You're going to be okay. You're going to come home to me. You're going to be with me. And guys, you know, all I thought was, you know, I'm not thinking I'm out. I think maybe there's a little bit of a problem, but all I really, 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 really thought was that I was flipping crazy. You know, I went to see this, and it says, you know, in our big book, you know, we'll find other, there's other help for us out there. And I went to this psychologist, and I sat across from her, and I asked her, I told her my story, what was going on. I just lost my son. I lost my mom. I can't. You know, I can't do my life. I'm crazy. And one of the key things she said to me is like, you know, there's going to be milestones in your life, in your new sobriety, things that probably happened to you on the streets before you came here, that are going to be those signs from God, that God put people in your life. God put, and I call them angels, people that are put in your life that convey a message to you that you remember. And word for word, this woman said to me, she said, when you lose a child, you lose your future. And when you lose a parent, you lose your past. And Marion, you're having trouble living in today. And I was, guys, I was. I was miserable. I sent my kids off on the Sunday school bus, and I ended up going to this little Baptist church to see them on a October festival. And on October 18th, 1988, I found a relationship with a higher power that I choose to call my Lord and Savior. And I can go add a whole lot more names to that that go with that name, but that's mine. And yours is yours, and your journey is yours. And what happened is I had alcoholic torture. You know, I have this heart full of God, and I have my alcoholism, and I'm going home, and I'm drinking, and I'm running back to this preacher, why can't I quit? And I'm going back and forth, and it was just like, you know, we always say a head full of AA and a belly full of booze doesn't mix. Well, a heart full of God and a belly full of booze is really, really, really crazy. It's really crazy making. And so what I ended up doing, you know, the night of November 10th, 1989, it was my birthday. I've got my matted hair. I've got my afro. I got my leopard print shirt. And I'm going out for my 30th birthday. But I first started that day with Bloody Marys at Denny's at 7 o'clock in the morning. Went home, passed out, forgot to get my kids from school. And I went out again that night for my birthday. And, you know, there's a place in our book, and it talks about, you know, being at that jumping off place. I couldn't see my life with a drink, and I couldn't see my life without a drink. And I also know, for me, I drank myself sober. There was not enough booze I could drink that night. There was nothing in particular that happened in that night that was any different than any other night. But I just, except for the fact I just couldn't get a buzz. I couldn't. And in this family, in this big family that I had, we have the little scapegoat, and that was my brother Eric, and he is a baby. And he'd gone to like 7 treatment centers, and oh my God, he was throwing rocks in the swimming pool and breaking windows and throwing snowballs with rocks on the freeway and breaking windshields, and he was crazy. And I was always like, he would come to my house and he would go steal a stereo, you know, an 8-track out of somebody's car, or a stereo out of their house, or a cassette player at that time, you know. He would steal out of their houses and stuff like that. And he'd come over and he'd want me to buy it from him and give him some money. And, you know, it's like he's out running and he's gunning, man, and he's doing all kinds of crazy things. And what was really hard about my alcoholism at the time, too, is I got a little sister who's popping pills and drinking wine in the morning. My brother Eric's living under a bridge and sticking stuff in his arm. And I'm looking at them, and I'm like, I've got, you know, I got a little swimming pool. I got a sandbox. I got the 3 kids. Sure, I drink a little, you know. And I'm looking, I'm pointing the finger out at them, and it's like, why don't you guys get your crap together? And, you know, another one of those warnings that happened for me was that little brother that lived under the bridge. And as I was reading him the riot act and pointing the finger out to him, when are you going to get your crap together? You've got a problem. He looked me dead in the eye and he said, one of these days, you're going to have a good, long, hard look in the mirror. And November 11th, 1989, that morning, I went down to my bright pink bathroom with my matted hair, and I still had the leopard shirt on. Ooh, I can't even wear that crap today. I can't. I mean, if it works for you, great. I think it's beautiful on everybody else. On me, it just doesn't work. I mean, I really admire it, okay? On me, it just reminds me of that. I can't. And I looked in the mirror and I saw something I never saw before. And I know I had an experience with God on another dimension. And what I was given that day was a gift of desperation. And what I saw in the mirror was myself for the first time. And I knew I needed help. And I knew I needed it bad. And you guys, like I said before, I was swearing off all the time, and it was going to be a brand new day. And I'd gone to my husband and said, I'm quitting this, I'm quitting that. You know, and in our book, it talks about how we, you know, here are the methods we try, switching from scotch to brandy, swearing off with or without a solemn oath, you know, joining health farms and sanitariums, you know, like all those things. I was like all over it. I'm going to manage, if I could only manage my life well, you know. And that day and that morning was a day of complete surrender. And I had this next door neighbor. His name was Daryl Hirschkorn, for total disclosure, who has a Hirschkorn last name. But he had gone to treatment because he had a problem with dry goods, and he had gotten like 6 months sober. And something that day, somewhere in that, the idea wasn't, oh, I'm going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't that. What came to me was, I need to go to treatment. And I came out to my husband for the 12 millionth time to tell him how I was going to get help. And I was going to go to treatment. And he pointed me to the refrigerator with the beer and maybe you need this and maybe you need to smoke that and maybe you need to do that. I was like, no, I need to go. And I called my big sister. I didn't even remember that part. I thought she just showed up, but apparently I called her, and I didn't even know that till a couple years ago. And I gave my sister a call, and I showed up at a treatment center with my husband's boxer shorts, with a big hoodie on, and my matted hair. And apparently, when you go to treatment, you do get an intake and interviewed and things like that, but that's not what I did. I just showed up, swung open the doors, and I need help. And then I need help now. And I entered the one and only treatment center of my entire life. And I've been clean and sober ever since. And I can tell you, I got things there that were beautiful. And I worked the first three steps there. But I was laying in that detox. And it was the third day. And I was sure I had overreacted. All right, I'm feeling good now. I'm gonna ready to go home, conquer the world. Thanks so much for your help. And I had informed the staff that I was ready to go. Thank you very much for taking care of me. I'm ready to go. And one of the most glorious, unforgettable days of my life that day. There was a therapist at the treatment center, and his name was Steve Nobles. And I can give his last name because he is no longer with us. This disease eventually did take him out. And he was about, I think he's taller than you, John. 6 foot, huge. And this little nurse named Becky Treat, I'm going to give her a whole name. And they came in and laying in that detox bed. And they sat at the end of the bed. And, wow, God really brought me into that moment. And their words, like our book talks about, had depth and weight. And I shook my head and said, that's me. That's me. They were AAs and they were talking about, you know, the things that every alcoholic wants to know. How come when I drink, I can't stop? You know, one drink doesn't mean one drink to me. It's about number two and three and four and five and whatever. How come I can't stop once I start? You know? And it changed my life. You know, a few days later, I had done, you know, that's why I love Alcoholics Anonymous. That went so deep in my heart that day. It was like, I had this God. And what I believe happened in that day for me was the worlds just collided. You know, this beautiful relationship I was forming with God. And I forgot to tell you, I would drink that box of wine and I had the Bible open and I'd be highlighting and I'd take another glass and it's like, and then the next day going, what's wrong with me, you know? And these people started opening, you know, the steps starting opening to me and things like that started happening. And just a few days later, you know, the only other person I know that was in AA just happened. And like, our spirit is open up, we don't know where the message is going to come from. We don't know who's going to say the right thing at the exact right time. I mean, heck, I mean, I sit here with 26, stand here with 26 years tonight. I mean, I listened to Ronnie today and yeah, buddy. Like, he gave me nuggets for my life today. You know, we don't know who's going to say the right thing at the right time at the right moment. We have no idea. What I do know is when the spiritual malady is overcome, we start to straighten out physically and mentally, right? So what ended up happening, I worked the first three steps at the treatment center. Treatment center style, 15 pages. You know, it was crazy. You know? And this woman I knew, her husband worked for my husband, and she you know, they said, well, we're going to give you a temporary sponsor, and she's going to show up and take you to a meeting tonight. And so she was going to show up and take me to a meeting that night, and she shows up at the treatment center. I had no idea, the only woman on the planet that I know in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it just happened to be her. Just happened to be her. What? She takes me to a meeting down at Dry Dock, which is this clunky old place with floors like this. And back in the day, 27 years ago, smoke billowing the rooms, right, Ray and John? You know, like, whoa, smoke billowing the rooms, a whole bunch of crusty old farts. And I'm going, great. Great. This is where, this is Friday night, and this is where I am, and this is where my life has brought me. Great. Cool. Dry Dock. And I'm doing it. And it's my head, guys. Just like before, when I'm sitting in detox, my body didn't need alcohol anymore, okay? I'm detoxed. What took me out was where our disease centers in the mind. And here's my mind one more time working overtime, and it wants to take me out. And it wants to take me out bad. And I sit down in that meeting, and I don't know if I ever, I don't know, I can picture this woman's face. I don't think I ever saw her again after that. But this little, beautiful, amazing Native American woman is sitting up against the wall, and she opens up her mouth. I've got tons of contempt prior to investigation. And she starts telling, sharing her experience. I don't even know what she said, but she was a mom, and she was hurting, and she was desperate, and she was broken, and she started saying that. And guess what? One more time again. That's me. Now that's me. And I made it past that hump again. It was like, yeah, this is where I belong. And then I started embracing those old timers. Those crusty old men become my best friends. And, you know, there was an old man named Don down there at Dry Dock, and he had a big book that looked 12,000 times worse than this, with coffee stains on it and rips and tears. And he'd get to the meeting early, and he'd make the coffee, and I'd get there, and I'd hang out with Don, and I'd hang out with Dixie, and I'd hang out with Ross, and I'd hang out with those crusty old timers. And I'm tell you, you know, we have a responsibility to pass on the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Me as a woman in good standing in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have responsibility to pass on the message, not watered down, what comes from this book, okay? And those old timers became my best friends. I had friends that were, I had a 15-year-old girl that was one of my best friends and an 80-year-old man, and I started listening. You know, they would tell me, oh, God, the old-timer thing, you know, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth, you know, things like that. You know, and when I'd get high and mighty, they'd say, Marion, get off the cross. We need the wood, you know. They would tell me stuff like that, you know. Pete, he used to introduce himself. He's a real alcoholic, and Pete would introduce, you know, he'd tell his story, and he'd say, like, I was like, yeah, I need a new job. I need a new job, and we need some food on the table. And he would sit there and he'd say, yeah, well, Marion, you can pray all you want for God to bring you some food. He's not going to throw a wiener through the window. You know, go out and get a job. You know, there's work that needs to be done, you know. And I love them today. I love them today. And guys, I want to just, oh, I was going to go into more about alcoholism, but I'm going to cut this off, you know, a little bit. What we need to remember in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you new people, like, who's pretty new? Pretty new. Okay? Who's been around a really long time? Pretty long time, right? Okay, I'm going to tell on you old timers. Here's a secret, new guys. They need you. I need you. There's no such thing of alcoholism. They told me it's alcoholism. And old timers can sit and they can die in these rooms. Because I'm not going to be vulnerable. And I'm not going to let you know about my pain. And I'm not going to, because after all, I've been sober almost 27 years. I'm not supposed to have any hurt. I'm not supposed to have any pain. You know what? Reach out to them too. Some of those crusty old timers which now I'm getting crusty. There's some crust happening. Definitely on these Florida feet. Women in sandals, crusty feet. Sorry. Whoa, don't look at the feet when you say hi to me at the end of this, okay? But the point is that they need you as much as you need them. And you know, the last thing we want to do, you know, there's times we forget the simplest things. We have this built-in forgetter, they told us. Yeah, I was a meeting maker for a long time, so I know lots of meeting maker slogans, but I know the book too. Pretty good. But most importantly and most emphatically, what I do have is a relationship with a higher power that I seek with the desperation of a drowning woman. I know that I have a daily reprieve today contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And without that, I'm sunk. I don't worship the hands, the fingers that point to the power. I worship the power, and from there, I get the fingers. Okay? I'm sober fully and totally by the mercy and grace of a loving God. Not because of the work I do. I get that love from God, and I get that mercy from God, and I get that grace gift from Him. And because of that, I get to do all those other things that point directly to Him. Okay? So if you're new in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, reach out to the old timers. And if you're an old timer, reach out to the newcomer. And it's going to be a journey over the next 12 weeks. I have 11 weeks left now. Woo. Shoo. I got Isabel coming next week. She's my stand-in. I love it. Girl power. So just in closing, that new girl that was in the bathroom that said, I wish I could be a big book thumper, and you wish you could be a big book thumper, there too is that grace for you. That grace is here for you. Am I supposed to be closing? I don't even know. No, I'm supposed to still go? Whoa. I'm just going to read a tiny bit. I'm going to read some big book because that's a good thing. I was just going to close. I was thinking it was 9. Okay. See, there's the Lucy moment. So in this home group of the Northwest Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I took my first commitment, and my first commitment was, ready to hear it? It's pretty big. I was the ashtray washer. And I'd pile those metal ashtrays in the sink, and I'd wash those ashtrays, put them back out on the table. And something happened in that. You know, Peter talks about the innocent climb, and it was the innocent climb. I became a member of that group. I was a member. And I had a service position, and I showed up to do it. I had a sense of belonging. And most importantly, that's a pretty gross job. It gets underneath your fingernails. Those people sit there, and they chain smoke. I mean, it was bad. It was billowy bad. Then you smoke a cigarette and join them, you know, but you're griping about everybody else, but I did. I did that. I griped. You know, so it would get under my nails, and it was dirty, and it was icky, and it was whatever. And I had a sense of belonging, and I had, you know, a responsibility in that group. But most importantly, when I was doing that, I wasn't thinking about me. And that's what plagues us, guys. It's either hero to zero. Yeah, I'm either the greatest thing, or I'm dirt under your feet. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the glorious gift of being able to look the world in the eye. And how I try to live my life today is a couple things that my sponsor instills in me, you know. Two very important things she instills in me. One is, Marion, just go help somebody. If I'm whining and I'm griping and so it's all about you, just go help somebody. And to pray for a servant's heart. Pray for a servant's heart. And the other piece is, I am, thank God for this. I was dirty little girl. I stand her in a dress and heels in front of you all in South Florida. And how did that happen? But it did. You'll hear more about that over the weeks. How did that happen? You know, and it was bit by slow, and it was little by little, and I'm here. And what it did is it gave me, Alcoholics Anonymous, guys, gave me the ability to look at each and every single one of you, look the world in the eye, and say that I am no better than you. I am no better than you. and I am no less than you. And that's the freedom that Alcoholics Anonymous gives us, is the ability to walk shoulder to shoulder, to walk hand in hand. You know, I went to an AA meeting in Bellingham, and my sponsor, it was her old home group, and she'd moved from Texas to California to Bellingham, and I was sitting there, and I was lonely, and I wasn't reaching out to anybody, and I'm just in it, you know, and she walks up to me and shakes my hand. She's like, "How you doing?" And I said, I was honest. I said, "You know, I feel really lonely tonight." She goes, "Oh, my God, I do too," and sits down. And another girl walks up, "How you doing? I feel really lonely." "Oh, okay, sit down." You know, I mean, that's what we get to do when we get to be honest about how we're feeling, is to be able to bring somebody else into that stuff, right? So, this is what I want to read about. Page 31 and more about alcoholism. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they're in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule. Therefore, non-alcoholic. If anyone who's showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we've tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. More about alcoholism starts by saying, you know, most of us have been unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. No person likes to think he's bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. You know, back in the day, there was the black velvet woman. It was on these big billboards, and she's laying across a piano in a long black velvet dress with her glass of black velvet. And I tried to drink like that. You know, I tried to drink like that, but I end up with a leopard shirt, matted hair, and a box of wine. But I was always trying to be her. You know, I want to look classy. I walk in. I've arrived. And the next day, the heel's broken, and I'm, like, in the lounge chair, still dressed in my clothes, and my eyes come to, and I'm looking out the window at my car to make sure there's no guts hanging from the front of the headlights. You know, that's what drinking looks like for me. So, I'm excited about this journey, and I really, really am going to wrap it up right now. But stay with me if you don't. I mean, I was kind of like, talk about contempt prior to investigation. Oh, last week's Peter, now this week's Mary, and I thought there'd be three people here. And I'm just thrilled, and it's really awesome to be here and be able to share my experience, strength, and hope with this book that has transformed and changed my life, and this fellowship that I wish I could just take a piece of my DNA, and if you're new and you're struggling, to just plop it in you. But instead, guess what, guys? This is a program of action. And it's not, we can't rest on our laurels. Remember, tell those old timers, tell them hi, reach out to them. It's good stuff. Because I die in these rooms too. I need, the farther away I get from a drink, the more I need this fellowship. I need it more today than I ever did. So thank you for letting me share my experience, strength, and hope, and God bless you all.
Okay, so let's all thank Miriam once again. Okay, we have tonight's session and all past speaker podcasts online for free at alcoholicsandgod.org. We'd like to invite everyone back for next Thursday and to our Monday night big book study. And for those who wish to thank tonight's speaker, which is Miriam, you just line up in the front, in the middle of the line, center aisle, and thank her, which is very good to do, I must say. And next week, Miriam is going to be out of town. So next week, we will have Isabel giving a special one-night talk for us. Okay. Fred? Help.
Don't do all that. Hi, my name's Fred, and I'm your recovered alcoholic secretary. In keeping with the seven tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. I've asked Alex to read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why many people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering, and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic.
I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Alex. We are not cured of alcoholism, recovered but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime, but we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in the body. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we are recovered.
...1940-style Big Book sponsorship, from the fourth to the second edition, Alcoholics Anonymous. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sobered at once and remained that way, 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, and come to believe and experience is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. Can I have a show of hands of recovered alcoholics? Is there anyone in need of a sponsor tonight? Please raise your hand. If you could just stand up for a moment, please. After the meeting, if we can all meet him up here. Please join us Monday nights. We have a Big Book study in the other room over here where the Big Book comes alive. Fellowship is at 6:30, and the meeting itself starts at 7:15. We have large print Big Book and Big Book dictionaries for sale. We meet every Thursday starting promptly at 8:15, and we ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the sound of the bells. Thank you, and I'll see you next week.
Okay, so don't forget to thank Miriam, and let's close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, Amen. Hallelujah.
Mike.
And I hope